In this hour of the show, the second hour of the program, we'll be talking about nitrogen pollution and particularly concentrating on North America. Our ability to take nitrogen and put it into a form that can be readily used by plants has certainly been a good thing for agriculture in many ways, and it has increased agricultural production. But now it seems that there is a growing number of scientists who are concerned about pollution, that is, too much nitrogen, both in the air and in the water, and the possibility that it could have some negative effects on human health. We'll try to explore the basic issues this morning in this part of the program as we talk with Robert Howarth. He is David R. Atkinson, Professor of Ecology and Environmental Biology at Cornell University, and is here visiting the campus to talk about this very subject with people here in Champaign-Urbana. He's good enough to come and spend some time with us. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. People who are listening can call in, ask your own question. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, please do pick up the telephone and call. And thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, David. I'm pleased to be here.
Nitrogen, obviously, is a naturally occurring element. It's in the air, and it's a basic sort of constituent of the natural world. But I guess that what we're talking about here, though, is an increase in nitrogen as a result of human activity, one way or another. And I guess basically on one source would be burning of fossil fuels, and the other would be what we have done to make it, as I said, something that's useful as a fertilizer that we can put on plants. And in both of those ways, apparently, we have added greatly to the amount of nitrogen that's out there. And I gather that relatively recently, within, say, the last 10, 15 years, there's been a very large growth in the amount of nitrogen we're putting out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the nitrogen is critical to all life. It's critical to agriculture. It's a good thing. It's a nutrient. In the natural world, 99.99% of the nitrogen on Earth is the molecular nitrogen that surrounds us in the atmosphere and is dissolved in the oceans. And its availability to organisms is very low. The bacteria can catalyze this reaction and make it available, but it's a slow process globally. Humans have managed to duplicate that process, and we've had the scientific know-how to do that for maybe less than 100 years. It really hasn't caught on as an industrial technology until after World War II, and it's accelerated since then. So as you say, there are two things going on. One is that when we burn fossil fuels, we inadvertently take some of this molecular N2 around us and make it reactive, biologically available. That's a mistake. The other thing is purposefully creating fertilizer, synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. And, you know, I think we have to say that's a good thing. With the population we have on Earth today, starvation would be massive if we didn't have that technology supporting agriculture. So you have to view it as a good thing. But we've done that quite recently, and we've done so without full realization of what the consequences are. I mean, as you mentioned, a lot of this has happened in the last 10 to 15 years. Half of all of the synthetic nitrogen fertilizer that's ever been used on Earth has been used in the last 15 years.
That's a really remarkable statistic, and I believe that came out of your research, some research that you were involved in.
It's using data from the United Nations, the Food and Agricultural Organization program. In the United States, you know, we started using synthetic nitrogen fertilizer a little bit in the 60s. It really took off in the 1970s. The rate's been going up a little bit since then, but you know, we've had a moderately stable situation for the last 20 years or so. But you look at developing countries, India and China, and their use of fertilizer has just exploded in the last 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we have sort of two major issues or two major avenues, ways that it gets in the environment. On the one hand, we have automobiles and, I guess, electricity-generating plants that are burning fossil fuels, and so it gets into the air. And breathing it in causes certain kinds of consequences. Then the other issue, the main issue, I suppose, is the fertilizer that we put on. We put it on farm fields. We also put it on golf courses. People put it on their lawns, and that runs off, and eventually that ends up getting into water, into groundwater, into rivers, streams, lakes, and the oceans. Taking that first part first, How, if you look at the total amount of nitrogen that, that we have through human activity put into the environment, how significant is the air component?
If you look at the global alteration of the nitrogen cycle, what we're doing in agriculture is a bigger, bigger flux. Globally, 75-80% of the increased nitrogen supply is associated with agriculture, and only 20-25% with this fossil fuel source. But that varies a lot regionally. Nitrogen is reactive stuff in these forms, so you see a lot of regional variation across the globe, across the continent. So, say in the northeast United States where I live, the atmospheric component's by far the biggest source, and fossil fuels are the biggest problem. Here in the Midwest, you know, agriculture is definitely the biggest problem and the biggest source.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, since that is, I'm sure that there are people who are listening who are involved in agriculture, and here that's a prime concern of people at the university. So the main, if we're looking at where the biggest source is, it is going to be from nitrogen fertilizer that is deliberately put put on the ground. Again, it's not just agriculture. There are these other cases. People do put it on their lawns, and they put it on golf courses and things like that.
That's
so you know, there it's we can't. It's not all farmers' fault, and I'm sure that farmers like to point out the fact that yeah, maybe they're doing it, but they're not the only source.
Yeah.
So when you look at all of those things, how significant is each of those components as a contributor?
Well, it really, I mean, you're correct. Fertilizer is used in all sorts of places and golf courses, and homeowners grossly over-fertilize compared to what farmers do.
Sure.
But still, there's a lot of farmland out there, and farmland is where most of the fertilizer is used, and 95% of it, say, here in the Mississippi River Basin. You know, overall, I think I don't want to lay the blame on farmers. I really do believe that the use of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer has allowed a level of food production that's made the earth a better place to live overall. But farmers could do a lot more to reduce the loss of nitrogen off of their fields. And you know, some of them are beginning to understand that more, and I think we're moving in a direction that's encouraging. Farmers are bright people, but their prime motive is to return a profit off of their farm. Secondarily, many of them do care about environmental issues. I think the real key here is to better educate the farmers on how they can maintain their productivity while also helping with this environmental issue. And there are all sorts of things they can do that they're beginning to do.
Well, how much could you do simply by applying less? And could you get the same effect, that thing that you're looking for, and at the same time apply less? Which I'm sure also farmers would say, well, that's a good thing, because the less I have to. Less I have to buy,
saves them some money.
It saves some money, because
yeah, exactly.
that's a big cost of production.
Yeah, exactly. You know, farmers vary a lot. The farm-to-farm use of fertilizer is very variable. But if you look at the statistics overall for the average farmer in the upper Midwest here, particularly during the 1990s, farmers use more fertilizer than is even in their economic interest. If they use less fertilizer and saved some of that cost of the extra fertilizer, their yields really wouldn't have suffered. They would have earned a higher profit. They've started to realize that. They're using less fertilizer now than they would have been 5 or 10 years ago. I think the data suggests they could use less fertilizer yet and still maintain an excellent yield. And there are some innovative programs that are moving them in that direction. Part of the problem is that, you know, farmers are risk averse. Live in a business where the profit margin is small. They have a tremendous amount of capital invested in their land and equipment. They really need, they can't afford to take risks with their investment. And so they tend to use fertilizer at moderately high rates, higher than research suggests is necessary, just in case they have that perfect growing year where they'd get a great crop if they use that extra fertilizer. They want to make sure they maximize that profit. There's some efforts, and I'll highlight one, which is the American Farmland Trust has set up. It's a experimental program, nonprofit, non-governmental organization. It's essentially set up an insurance pool to take the risk out of having farmers use less fertilizer. So farmers join this program. They use less fertilizer. They save money by using less fertilizer, and they take some of that savings and they invest it in the nonprofit fund, the insurance pool, basically. And then on their fields, they have some test strips of land which are heavily fertilized, very heavily fertilized. And at the end of the growing season, one goes out and compares the productivity on the land as a whole with what it is in the very heavily fertilized strips. If, in fact, their productivity is lower on the average land because they've used less fertilizer, then this fund reimburses them the cost of the lost yield. Otherwise, the fund keeps the funds and keeps accumulating. Either way, the farmer saves money and less fertilizer is used. And what we're finding is that, indeed, the fund very seldom pays out because the farmers have been over-fertilizing. But this allows them to see so in a way that bears no economic risk to them.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert Howarth. He's a professor of ecology and environmental biology at Cornell University. And he's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about nitrogen pollution. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller over by Danville in Belgium, nearby, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sirs.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to explore fertilization in itself, and that is, you know, people in towns, they know fertilizer is just what they sprinkle in their yard is granules, and it incorporates itself into the yard or in the garden and fertilizes the animals, the plants. However, the way it's done in agriculture is it's injected as ammonium hydroxide. No, ammonium. Is that ammonium hydroxide? But it's ammonium gas, anyway. And it's plowed into the ground fairly deeply. And it's done, not quite now, but maybe about a month from now when it's a little bit colder. Now, it seems that there'd be a great deal more loss because of its being injected into the ground and it evaporate into the air and just generally dissipate much quicker because of the gas structure. Why isn't there been some technology to move in a different direction and thereby also reducing the amount of nitrogen that's placed on the ground and subsequently less loss going down to the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, that's a good question, and there is a tremendous amount of research on how to better use nitrogen fertilizer. A lot of it's done on this campus and a lot of other campuses across the country, in fact. There's a lot of complexity behind it. You referred to the ammonia use and the anhydrous ammonia is a major fertilizer use, less so now than would have been true 10, 15 years or so ago. And in fact, the deep injection of the ammonia helps. If you surface apply the ammonia, you lose more to the atmosphere. So the technology that you refer to for deep injecting that actually is more effective at keeping it in the soil. That's an improvement that was made probably in the late 1980s, early 1990s. The latest trend in fertilizer use, at least nationally, I'm not sure about locally here, but on average in the upper Midwest, is towards using urea. And urea is an organic nitrogen form, but again, it's made synthetically using fossil fuels. And it has its advantages to the farmer. It's easier to handle. It's not as explosive or toxic. It weighs less than, say, nitrate forms as a fertilizer, so it's cheaper to move around. But it has its own set of problems. A lot of it can volatilize off to the atmosphere. A lot of it can leach directly to surface waters, where there's some recent evidence suggesting it more than average fertilizers might perpetuate harmful algal blooms. So there are problems associated with that use. I think there's a lot. You mentioned also in your question that farmers maybe in the next month will get out and start spreading the fertilizer. They do that because the ground's firmed up. It's frozen. It's easy to get the tractors out there. They have time on their hands. But there's plenty of research showing that when you fertilize in the fall or winter in this sort of climate, you lose a lot of that fertilizer in the spring runoff period, and that if you can handle it, you're more effectively using the fertilizer if you apply it in the spring or during the summer. Much, much better for the environment.
I see. I had another question. It just faded from my mind. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And again, our guest, Robert Howarth, he's professor of ecology, environmental biology at Cornell University. Perhaps I should give you the opportunity to talk a little bit more about the environmental impact of this nitrogen, because we sort of took it for granted the fact that it's a problem, right. Particularly when it gets into where we're talking about runoff that ends up in streams, rivers, in coastal waters. How is it that is a problem?
Well, the coastal problem is really a major problem globally now, but also in the United States. This nitrogen that runs off, much of it does reach coastal waters. There it acts like a fertilizer. It stimulates algal growth, and we end up with excessive amounts of growth, which the most obvious effect of that is when the material dies, it consumes oxygen in the water, and we have all sorts of ecological damage from that. There are more subtle effects, too. We lose seagrass habitat. We have subtle ecological changes, alteration in the food webs, which are deleterious for the sort of things we care about, fish and fisheries. Here in the United States, we believe that two-thirds of our coastal rivers and bays are now either moderately or severely degraded from this nitrogen pollution. So that is probably the biggest pollution problem facing the oceans, at least from the United States perspective. There's less data on that in many parts of the world outside of the United States, but the United Nations Environmental Program issued a report last spring saying that this nitrogen coastal pollution is perhaps one of the three or four greatest global environmental challenges facing the Earth as a whole.
And so it's not just a problem in the United States, it's a problem all over.
Yeah, that's correct. And increasingly, as we see synthetic fertilizer used more in the developing world, it's good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good for the people of China and India. Starvation is way down. The diet and health is improved. There's no doubt about that. But we need to also be cognizant of the environmental consequences of that. And those countries, too, are beginning to realize that. They're beginning to try to grapple with how one balances these.
Mm-hmm. And as we said before, there can be a variety of sources. And there has, I think, been some controversy about the contribution of agriculture. And I suppose depending upon where it is you're talking about, you could be talking about different sources. But at least here, if we talk about the Midwest and particularly the concerns that a lot of people have voiced now for a number of years about what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. for example, there we seem to get into some arguments about, well, okay, who is responsible? What is primarily responsible? There is it, as far as you're concerned, is it pretty clear that really what we are talking about here is runoff from farm fields and agriculture is the
yes,
prime response?
Absolutely, in this area. I mean, let me preface my response by saying that I think in some parts of the country and some parts of the world, it isn't clear at all. And if you look at Chesapeake Bay, which has a terrible problem with nitrogen pollution, the scientific evidence on sources is very confused. There are several different contradictory studies, and I don't think we have a good handle on what's going on in Chesapeake Bay. On the other hand, for the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico situation, there's a large body of science, several diverse types of information brought to bear, all of which show pretty conclusively that the hypoxia is caused by nitrogen, and the nitrogen is coming from the upper Midwest, predominantly agricultural sources. At least 70% of it's from agricultural sources. I really think that's beyond question at this point.
Yeah. Is this something that's reversible?
Yes, I believe it's reversible. The time between the use of a fertilizer and it's running down the river is there aren't huge lags associated with that. I mean, the best study of the reversibility we have is an inadvertent experiment. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union, agriculture basically disappeared from Eastern Europe in a very short period of time. Soviet Union was subsidizing that area with synthetic fertilizer. That source went away, hasn't really been replenished. Now, as of the late 1980s, the Black Sea, which is a coastal water body downstream of the of that area, drained by the Danube, et cetera, was suffering exactly the same sort of problems that we see in the Gulf of Mexico. Large deterioration of water quality that had occurred over about a 15 or 20 year period leading up to that. With the collapse of synthetic fertilizer use, the Black Sea started to recover within 3 to 4 years and recovered markedly. Its health now would be similar to what it was 40 years ago, prior to any use of synthetic fertilizer. So that tells us that, at least for that landscape, the recovery is fairly rapid. I think we know enough to suggest that would also be true in the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we talk a little bit more about what we have seen happening in the Gulf of Mexico, in case people really aren't have not followed the story and are not really, really sure about what the effect has been. You know, they may have heard about this. They may have heard a term like hypoxia, or they may have heard about, let's talk about dead zones.
Right.
But may not exactly be sure.
What is a dead zone?
What is a dead zone? You know, what is it that really you're talking about?
Right. The problem is one of excess nitrogen stimulating excess phytoplankton growth. So these are microscopic algae living up in the water column off of the mouth of the Mississippi River. The currents in the Gulf of Mexico move this water along the continental shelf, along the Louisiana shelf to the west. And as they get a large increase in the growth of phytoplankton there, and as it dies off and sinks into the bottom water, the oxygen levels are diminished. That's what we call hypoxia. We're looking at concentrations of oxygen that might be a quarter of what they would normally be. And that starts to put a large stress on the animal community that would live in the area. In extreme events, the oxygen will actually go to zero, and of course that's deadly to lots of things. The dead zone isn't dead in that organisms don't live, and in some ways it's a misnomer, because what we have is too much phytoplankton life. Mm-hmm. But it's a diminishment in the sort of animal life that society values. And it's covered a fairly large area. The best work on that is by Nancy Rabelais from Louisiana University Marine Consortium. And she and colleagues have shown, they've tracked this now over several years, some areas, the hypoxic area, the low oxygen area, is much larger than others. I think we now have an excellent understanding from her work and that from people at NOAA, like Don Scavia, that can very accurately predict what the area will be based on the climate in the Mississippi, how much nitrogen. Wet years brings more of this fertilizer down than dry years. So we see year-to-year variation in the hypoxic zone associated with that. And also storm events in the Gulf of Mexico. Hurricanes are a good thing, and they break up the water column and replenish the oxygen and can change that. So. But there's a general trend towards this area getting larger over time, subject to this interannual variability due to storms and climate.
Yeah, and so what you're having is overstimulation of growth of organisms that would have been there anyway.
That's right.
There would be a normal part of the ecosystem. It's just that by pouring all this nutrient in there, you're overstimulating one sort of component.
Yeah, that's right. We're overstimulating them, resulting in more growth than is overall healthy for the community. And you're also in that, you're selecting for different types of algae, and you're selecting mm-hmm. for things that are probably not as good for the ecological structure that would lead to, say, the shrimp fisheries.
Yeah, and that really is the bottom line. The problem has been, or it has been a problem for commercial fishing, because now this means that if you're going to fish, you just got to go further and further out.
You have to go further out. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have another caller here. Let's talk with them in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, we know in terms of smog what the impact on humans is. You know, there's growing more and more evidence there. What's the impact on humans on this one? You know, direct impact in terms of problems that, you know, individuals can have.
Well, in terms of the coastal water quality, I think we're largely talking about degradation of environmental quality, loss of fishery resources, and, of course, that has indirect effects on health, but not a direct health effect.
There is no direct health effect then?
Well, no, there is, because associated with this, we're also seeing increased incidences and occurrences of what we call increased duration of what we call harmful algal blooms. And these are specific types of algae that produce toxic substances. They're naturally occurring organisms. They've been around. You can read about blooms of these things in the Bible, so we know they've been around for millennia. But we also have good evidence at this point that the length of these blooms and where they're occurring is increasing, and it seems to be stimulated by nitrogen pollution. So these are things which produce toxins that might accumulate in shellfish and can cause human poisoning, sometimes death. Sometimes paralysis, more commonly diarrheal sort of things. There's also some evidence that this coastal nutrient pollution can increase the occurrence of vector-borne diseases like cholera. We don't see it in the United States, but in developing countries where cholera is already present, when we degrade the coastal water quality, the cholera bacterium is longer lived. It seems to be carried along with these blooms, and we see increased diseases of that sort. Now, more broadly, I mean, nitrogen isn't just degrading these coastal waters. It is contaminating the atmosphere, and you mentioned smog. I mean, the ozone pollution is a big, big public health problem. The American Lung Association estimates that there are 30,000 premature deaths of Americans each year from ozone pollution in the air. That ozone pollution is caused by nitrogen pollution coming from fossil fuel sources.
So I understand. The Midwest is one of the high. It's the highest concentration, right, in terms of nitrogen. Is that correct?
For the atmospheric sources.
Well, not but in terms of ground.
In terms of groundwater, it's very high. And another issue is nitrate in drinking water, and there are all sorts of health risks associated with that. One of which is what we call blue baby syndrome, the hemoglobin in babies is tied up by the nitrate and isn't as effective in moving oxygen through, so this is a health risk. But nitrate in groundwater also poses a cancer risk and can increase other diseases as well.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Also, I think one of the things that I read about was that increased nitrogen in water somehow makes it more hospitable to mosquitoes, and that it's actually good for them and their breeding. And of course, that leads to concern because we have mosquito-borne diseases like encephalitis and West Nile. Mm-hmm. More mosquitoes, theoretically, that could mean more disease.
Yeah, you're referring to a paper that Alan Townsend, the University of Colorado, led a group on a year or so ago, and he basically got a bunch of medical scientists and ecologists and all to think as creatively as we could about what this human alteration of the nitrogen cycle means for health. The mosquito aspect is one part of it, because of course there are a variety of different mosquitoes that carry diseases, and they vary a lot in their ecological responses to the environment. Some of those species definitely are encouraged by water of lower water quality. The one that carries West Nile fever is clearly associated with that, and so we do believe that nitrogen pollution could contribute to West Nile fever spread. For malaria, it's more complicated because there are many different species of mosquitoes involved, and some of them like dirty water and some of them like clean water, and it's what we tried to call for is more of a science challenge to think more broadly about this issue than people have. Let me mention one other health effect, sure, which came out of that same report by Alan Townsend, and that refers to allergies. And we know that allergies are way up in the United States over what they were a few decades ago, and there are a variety of reasons that might be true. There's a tremendous amount of debate in the medical literature about that. But one of the things we also know is that there's a lot more pollen in the atmosphere than there used to be. And a lot of the pollen that people are allergic to, ragweed, things of that sort, are weeds that are highly responsive to nitrogen fertilization. You fertilize ragweed and you increase its growth a little bit, but you increase its pollen production incredibly because that's what it means to be a weed. You throw out more material as you try to reproduce and spread yourself around. Mm-hmm. So we believe it's the least plausible hypothesis that this increased nitrogen flux through the atmosphere is responsible for the increased pollen and at least part of the epidemic of allergies that we see in the United States.
We have someone else to talk with. This is, again, Urbana, an Urbana listener, line two. Hello.
Yeah, it's good to hear the issue being discussed because it seems issues that where there's a direct tug of war between local economy and pollution effects, including public health and ecosystem disruption, are often difficult to get on locally. So this is really great. I have a quick question, and I've got to hang up and listen to you on the air. But I understood that the Netherlands in Europe was also a big hot spot for nitrogen pollution, and if that's so, I was wondering if you knew anything about the way they were handling that between the Netherlands and the surrounding countries. No, I'm going to have to hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
That's an excellent question. The Netherlands is indeed a hotspot of nitrogen pollution. They have an incredible dense population there. Most of their nitrogen problem is from agriculture, and there it's largely an animal agricultural issue. They have tremendous populations of farm animals, pigs, but also poultry and other things, and tremendous amounts of nitrogen waste associated with that. In a way, they're a microcosm for parts of what's going on in the United States. Here in the United States, we grow corn, soybeans here in the Midwest, and we ship it to poultry farms in Maryland and hog farms in North Carolina, and you end up with a tremendous amount of animal concentration waste in those areas, which is very problematic, very polluting. If you go back 30 or 40 years, those animal wastes would have been returned to the field in some systematic way and reused as fertilizer. This large use of synthetic fertilizer has allowed us to break that chain. It's cheaper to buy synthetic fertilizer than it is to move manure back to Illinois from North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing in the Netherlands is that they import grains from all over the place. They import it from the United States, but also from many other countries, and they use that to support these really massive animal populations. And then they have this tremendous amount of waste that they use in their local farms, but it's in excess by huge amounts over what the crop needs there really are. They've taken, they actually, as opposed to what we do in the United States here, they've moved into a regulatory framework where they determine how much nitrogen a farm can actually use. They've set limits on the total mass of nitrogen allowed on a farm on a per area, per time basis. And they're trying to regulate that way in what they call a nitrogen management plan, but with a regulatory framework behind it. They have some success. Things, I think, are moving in the right direction, but slowly. And the consensus of their scientists now, I was at a meeting discussing this just a few weeks ago, is that they are nowhere near where they need to be. They have total nitrogen inputs to the farm fields that are in the neighborhood of 250 to 300 pounds per acre, whereas a farmer here in the upper Midwest might be using in terms of synthetic fertilizer, maybe 170, 180 pounds per acre, which several of us still think is too much, but they're almost twice as high as that in the Netherlands. So they have a long way to go yet.
All right. Another caller again, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if the incidents or the problem with agricultural runoff of nitrogen couldn't in part be mitigated and is part of a kind of a larger ecological problem of a lack of green space and farming right up adjacent to waterways, and if the runoff from nitrogen might in fact be mitigated if there were green spaces allowed for natural absorption of the nitrogen before it reached waterways. I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's another excellent question. There's a little complexity behind my answer. There are a tremendous number of things farmers can do to reduce the problem in addition to using less fertilizer. And one, let me just state before I get on to your answer, is to move into different cropping systems, say maybe use perennial crops instead of corn or soybean, so that during the springtime when nutrient levels are often very high in soils, there are roots available to take up the nutrients rather than let them run off. If the farmer doesn't want to do that, then planting winter cover crops is a huge help, again, so that there's living biomass out there to absorb those nutrients in the spring. The greenbelt idea and the idea of having a buffer between the field and the waterway is a good one. It's somewhat effective, subject to a constraint. If you put a drainage ditch, drain tile, from your field and have that underlie and go underneath this greenbelt right to the creek, then the greenbelt looks nice but is ineffective at controlling the nitrogen flux. And in a lot of cases, that's what we've done. A case in point, in the Chesapeake Bay area, the state governments have been trying pretty hard since the mid-1980s to reduce nitrogen pollution. Greenbelts are one of their major mechanisms for doing that, but they paid insufficient attention to whether the greenbelts were really intercepting the groundwater flow of nutrients from the field or not. And we now know they needed to pay more attention to that. Of course, in a flat terrain like this, if you don't have those drain tiles underlying it, then you have a hard time getting the water off of the field, and the farmers will tell you that will really trash their productivity. So. Mm.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Robert Howarth. He's a David R. Atkinson Professor of Ecology and Environmental Biology at Cornell University. We're talking about nitrogen pollution. Questions are welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, we're certainly getting into the area that I wanted to make sure that we hit, and that is, what is it that we can do to reduce the problem, and that fortunately there are some things that can be done, and we talked about things that farmers can do to starting out to use less mm-hmm. fertilizer, and then also make sure that they lose less. That is, whatever they put on actually gets used, gets taken up by the plants, so that it doesn't end up just running off. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the kind of advice that farmers are getting about addressing a problem in both those ways?
I'm not entirely sure how effective we are at yet communicating this directly to the farm community. I think we are just beginning to get there. But the farmers receive their information in a variety of ways, and I don't think they're hearing the message in a consistent voice, if you will. The academic extension agents might be giving one set of advice, but the Farm Bureau is probably speaking with another voice. They haven't yet acknowledged this as a problem, and they try to argue, in fact, that it's not. So I think we have a way to go in giving the farmer consistent information. But to me, as a scientist who's worked on this issue for 25 years, the biggest frustration is that the need to do something has never been more clear. This is a major environmental problem, and we do have technical solutions. Technical solutions are there for agriculture. They're there for the automotive sources and the industrial sources. What we lack is a good political leadership and good policy framework for moving it ahead, and that's been frustrating. On the other hand, I think we're making progress in any event, just from the groundswell up, if you will. I mentioned earlier that the American Farmland Trust, which is an NGO, has taken this innovative step of setting up a nonprofit insurance program to encourage farmers to use less fertilizer. I think that sort of thing is likely to be effective. It's in the farmer's economic interest as well as good for the environmental quality to do that sort of thing. So I think we're moving in the right direction, if slowly.
Another caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
How does sewerage treatment plants prevent sewer affluent, from causing nitrogen pollution?
Okay, a good question. I haven't mentioned sewage yet. In some areas, sewage is actually the largest source of nitrogen. In the state of New York, where I work now, Hudson River Estuary, the biggest problem is sewage, and that would be true of Long Island Sound as well. There's a paradoxical problem there. Historically, sewage, you pull the sewage together in much of the United States until the 1950s, 1960s, we didn't treat sewage at all. We called that primary treatment, but it really meant no treatment at all. Most everywhere in the country by the 1980s or 90s received what we called secondary treatment, and that's really designed to remove the organic matter out of sewage so that you're not putting a big oxygen load in receiving water bodies. It was not designed, was not intended to do anything at all for nutrients. It does take a little bit of nitrogen and phosphorus out. It takes about 15% of the total flow of both nitrogen and phosphorus out of the waste stream. But paradoxically, by improving the immediate water quality downstream of a sewage treatment plant within a mile or so of the plant, a lot of the nitrogen that's discharged from the plant ends up going further. You're diminishing what the natural bacteria were doing right outside of the plant. And so in some cases, we've seen examples where the downstream nitrogen pollution got worse after we just went to secondary treatment plants.
So we still have a problem.
Oh, yeah. And there are technologies there. We call them nutrient reduction technologies or maybe tertiary treatment technologies. For nitrogen, the trick is to try and convert it back to N2 gas, in which case it's no longer a problem. Technology's there. For a large city, it's moderately expensive. It costs around 5 to 10 cents per person on the sewage treatment plant per year in a sustained way to treat nitrogen, which doesn't sound like much, but you add it up for a city like New York, and you're talking big money all of a sudden. So.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, this again points to the fact that it is a complicated problem, and depending upon geographically where you're talking about, the source of the problem can be something different. As you have said, you think that, for example, if you're talking about the Gulf of Mexico, the primary problem is runoff from farm fields. There may be other places in coastal areas where the problem is large livestock operations, and then there may be other places where the problem are big cities that are on the coasts, like New York City, and you see it other places, and I'm sure you see it other places around the world. And there, it's basically the problem is the waste that's produced by human beings, large concentrations of human beings. So it's a different, you know, the point source is different depending upon where it is that you're talking about.
And then you throw in the fossil fuel atmospheric transport source, the deposition of this acid rain containing nitrogen. It's another problem yet. What they have in common is that in the receiving waters, they all cause the same problem, and we're seeing growth in it from all of these sources.
Mm-hmm. Does how much of a problem is, I guess, when we were talking before about the problem of atmospheric pollution, and when you talk about its effect on human health, I guess there I'm thinking about the fact that people are it has an impact on air quality and the air that people breathe. But again, if you go to environmental issues, how big a problem is deposition through rainfall that it gets up, burning fossil fuels gets up into the environment, but then it also comes back down, the effect of rain, and then again you end up, that ends up getting in surface water and groundwater. Does that add a lot to the total problem?
It can. In some regions, that deposition onto the landscape with subsequent transport of the nitrogen downstream can be the largest source of nitrogen to coastal waters. I mentioned earlier that we have a big debate in the scientific community about what's really going on in Chesapeake Bay in terms of the sources. One of those debates is how important atmospheric deposition is. Some of us think it's the primary source of nitrogen to Chesapeake Bay. Other people disagree with that. My own science tends to say it's very high, but there are problems with all of our science, including mine, in that area, and so we don't entirely know. It's a hot area of research. Nitrogen deposition has other ecological effects. The United States has done a better job of controlling sulfuric acid in acid rain over the last two decades, but we haven't done such a good job with controlling nitrogen and nitric acid, and so at this point, acid rain in the United States is increasingly a nitrogen problem. It's a bigger problem than the sulfur pollution. And beyond just acidifying lakes and streams and contributing this nitrogen downstream to coastal systems, the nitrogen can have an effect on forests and on the terrestrial landscape. And there's some very convincing studies recently out of Europe showing that where atmospheric deposition is high, the biotic diversity of the landscape is decreasing, has decreased remarkably over the last two decades. And there's some new evidence out of Canada suggesting that forest productivity in eastern Ontario is going down as a result of nitrogen deposition onto the forested landscape.
Yeah. Let's talk again with another caller. This is someone in Champaign. It's line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I am late listening, but I wondered if you might say something about the excess use of nitrogen on lawns. It seems to be a fairly massive problem some places.
Yeah, I mentioned that just briefly early on. Homeowners who fertilize tend to massively over-fertilize. Homeowners aren't as conscientious as farmers, really, and not as cost-conscious either. It's cheap to add it. In localized areas, that can be a big problem. If you take a coastal area like Cape Cod, Massachusetts, with really sandy soils and lots of green lawns, that's a big part of the problem. But in general, in a large area here like the Mississippi, it's a tiny fraction of the nitrogen compared to what agriculture is doing.
Thanks very much, then.
All right. Thank you. And again, we have about 5 minutes left. Someone wants to call with a question. They want to call real quick. We can get them in. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I guess I'm a little bit interested in an earlier comment you made. And I don't know how I want to get too political in the conversation. But I guess I wonder about cases where arguments like this or discussions like this do become politicized, and that certain positions become associated with certain political persuasions, and that somehow makes sometimes the discussion difficult because, you know, one side ends up being labeled sort of the liberal way of looking at things, and one side is the conservative way of looking at things. And it seems that it'd be more productive in a scientific sort of sense if we just toss that stuff aside, mm-hmm. and just looked at a more straightforward kind of discussion about, okay, what's the problem? What are the sources? What do we do about it? I mean, is this a case in which you think politics is actually getting in the way of our understanding what's going on and then moving toward a solution?
Yeah, no, actually, I don't think politics has gotten in the way. I made a comment about the failure, the lack of political leadership, but it's not a I think it's been a bipartisan
failure. Oh, good.
I don't think this topic is on the radar screen of most politicians of any political persuasion. It's surprising to me because you talk to the scientific community who study it, and we all believe it's a major problem compared to many other environmental issues which are discussed with much more prominence in the press or politically. But it might be because of the complexity of sources and the complexity of issues. It's also a problem which is still relatively recent. These issues have just cropped up in the last few decades, and you know, maybe it takes that long for science to sink into the public consciousness.
So. Well, it's interesting, you know, and given the amount of attention, for example, that's just devoted to an issue like global climate change,
mm-hmm.
Which is also complex. It's sort of surprising that then this that seems to be equally important, and you can demonstrate that it has effects on human health, hasn't got the amount of attention. Now, maybe that's a media issue, that for some reason that the news media just hasn't grabbed onto that the way that they have grabbed onto the other.
I think it takes time. I mean, I remember first hearing about global climate change when I was a undergraduate student in my early days of graduate school back in the early 1970s. And there were plenty of scientists then talking about global change as an issue. It certainly wasn't in the media at that time. It took mm-hmm. a few decades for it to come around. This nitrogen issue really has developed since then. You know, this is an issue that has come into its own in terms of the problems during the 1980s and 1990s. It is a global change issue. It's the result of humans changing the face of the Earth very, very quickly. In some ways, what we're doing with nitrogen is a much more rapid rate of change than what we're seeing with climate or carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But precisely because it's so rapid and relatively new, I think there's a long lead time here before this complex science sinks into the public consciousness.
Trying to get one more caller here. Another person listening this morning in Bloomington, Indiana, our line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I need a recommendation of a book on soil science that you think would be helpful, applicable to layman homeowners who have not read The Nature and Property of Soils by Buckman and Brady and don't have access to the 57-year book of agriculture, that book on soils. Can you think of something?
Oh, not off the top of my head. And true confessions, I'm an oceanographer by training, so I'm talking a little bit about agriculture here. I'm not a soil scientist. I will say, though, that the University of Illinois here has some excellent people. I think there's some very well-informed nitrogen experts in the Department of Natural Resources in particular. I'd refer you to them.
Okay.
Surely over there in Bloomington, somebody at the university there or maybe up at Purdue would be able to answer
Absolutely.
A question like that.
There's also an excellent book by Vaclav Smil, which came out, I think, in 2003, called Enriching the Earth, and sort of the history of change in nitrogen over the last century. Fascinating reading and a great introduction to the general topic.
Well, David, I did take the agronomy courses at Purdue, but I was left with this challenge of introducing this whole complex arena of soil science to homeowners here in Bloomington.
Ah.
And I realized that very few people were going to take the time to go, A, to Purdue or read the Nature and Property book of soils by Buckman and Brady, both from Cornell. And so I landed up recommending certain chapters from the 57-year book of agriculture, which is basically oriented toward farmers and people who have not gone to university. But I was hoping that there was something a little bit, had it been crystallized a little bit more directly toward my concern these homeowners.
Another series you might look at, it's a little off topic in terms of just the soil science, but the Ecological Society of America has been putting out a series of reports, which they call Issues in Ecology, and they're about 10 to 12 page things, very solid science behind them. They're endorsed by panels of the Ecological Society, but they're done, written for the lay public. And Peter Vatusik wrote one of those in 1997 on this global nitrogen issue. I was the lead author of one in 2000 on the coastal nitrogen issue, and I think both of those would be good general source books on the nitrogen problem.
Oh, terrific. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, we're just about the point we're going to have to finish. I guess the question I'm left with is this something that you think we are going to be hearing more about?
Well, the problem's not going away, and I'm sure we'll be hearing a great deal more about it. The science is becoming increasingly clear-cut, and I think the scientific community is increasingly becoming dedicated to moving this on as a topic that needs solving. I view where we are with this nitrogen issue as about where we were with reaching the public with climate change 20 years ago. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it.
Well, I thank you very much for being with us to talk about it.
Appreciate the opportunity to do so. Thank you.
Our guest, Robert Hoth. He's David R. Atkinson, Professor of Ecology and Environmental Biology at Cornell University, here visiting campus of the University of Illinois.